Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation where the rivers run clean through the forests of green where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with peace.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can review past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, or you can friend us on Facebook. Today's program is about the Iraq War and Thomas E. Ricks. After 21 years of conflict with Iraq, is there something we can learn? To break it down, the Gulf War started on August 2nd, 1990, and ended in 1991. Then, the Iraq no-fly zone started in 1991 and ended in 2003. And the current war in Iraq started in 2003. In this interview about the Iraq War with Thomas E. Ricks, he's interviewed by Harry Chrysler. Thomas E. Ricks has led an interesting life. Reviewing the conduct of the Iraq War, he analyzes the weaknesses and strengths of America's political and military leaders, the long-term consequences of the conflict, and the future of Iraq and the possibilities of a new American strategy for the Mideast under President Obama.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Chrysler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Thomas Ricks, who is a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. He is contributing editor at Foreign Policy, where he also blogs. He's the author of a number of books, including two books on the Iraq War, Fiasco, the American Military Adventure in Iraq, and The Gamble, General Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq. 2006 to 2008. He is on the Berkeley campus in the spring this year as the Nimitz lecturer. Tom, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Beverly, Massachusetts. My father was a professor at the time at Harvard and then later moved to Brandeis. And then I was raised there in New York when my father moved to Columbia University, and then later on in Afghanistan from 1969 to 1971. I was a teenager there.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Mainly through the extraordinary freedom they gave me. My parents had six kids, and in military terms, they were vastly outnumbered. It was the 1960s, I think, which also was kind of overwhelming. Well, I had older brothers and sisters who were off doing crazy things and calling my parents in the middle of the night from California. We were in New York. The result was when we lived in Afghanistan, I was 13, 14, 15, I was young enough to really not be noticed by adults much, old enough to absorb the language very quickly, and smart enough to skip school all the time. And so I spent a lot of time down in the bazaar hanging out in the old city in Kabul, exploring Kabul. I made it my ambition to get to every town in Afghanistan with a population of more than 5,000. I made it to everyone except Faizabad in the northeast. I would hop on buses, go to Kandahar, go to Herat, go down to Pakistan, which is the nearest bookstore. My parents, a lot of the time, had no idea where I was. I actually took a bus once from Kabul to Germany, through Iran and Turkey and so on.
And this would have been what years, actually?
1969, 1970, 1971, which is kind of an, Afghans tend to look back on it as the golden era. It really was kind of thriving. The U.S. and the Soviets were both pouring aid into the country. And Kabul had actually become kind of an intellectual refuge, both for Pakistanis and for Iranians. Kabul got some new hotels up and so on. I was once talking to the assassinated prime minister of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto, and she told me that as a teenager, she used to go up to Kabul to party. Mm. And she had a reputation, actually, for partying pretty hard. Mm-hmm. But they go up to the Intercontinental Hotel to dance and stuff, things she couldn't do in Pakistan at the time.
Now, how do you explain your adventuresome streak? Was it because your father was an academic? And what was his field? And what was the impetus for your already becoming, sounds like, a reporter in about to be?
It's interesting. Years later, actually, I picked up the novel Kim. Mm-hmm. By Rudyard Kipling. And this was the life I was leading. Mm-hmm. Knocking around the bazaar, talking in local languages. I actually dressed in Afghan clothes a lot just because it made life easier as you're moving around. Maybe a reporter to be, but also a writer to be. We had no television then. Afghanistan was one of the last countries without a television. And because I skipped school, I read a lot of books. I tended to read a book a day there. And so that's one reason I went down to Peshawar. My parents would give me $100. Books were cheap down in Peshawar. I'd go down and buy 20 books, go back a month later and buy another 20.
More to do than can ever be done. There's far too much to take in here. More to find than can ever be found. But the sun rolling high in the sapphire sky keeps waiting small on the endless round. It's the circle of life.
And what was the state of Islam in Afghanistan at that time? Was there evidence of the of the extreme religiosity, or was it really a dynamic place where the modern world was meeting the traditional world?
You had all those elements there.
Yeah.
Kabul was a very cosmopolitan city, a sense of sort of being an open city. At the same time, there were a lot of women who were not wearing the chadri, the cover, and there were incidents of acid being thrown in their faces. My sister and I, when we were new there, were walking down Jati Maywand, which is a main road in the old city in Kabul. She was 18 at the time. She was wearing long pants, but I think her arms were uncovered from the elbow down, and she was hit by a rock. So there were elements out there. But I felt extraordinarily safe from the country. Really, just I would literally hop on buses. I think it was 75 cents, 50 Afghanis at the time, to take the bus from Kabul to Kandahar. Check into a chaihana, a tea house, usually 10 afs, or 15 cents for the night. And then hop another bus to Herat. Really just knock around the country, go hiking in the hills and so on. It was a lovely, lovely time.
And then where were you educated?
I went to the American International School of Kabul, which was a State Department-sponsored school. Showed up frequently.
Sometimes.
Didn't do particularly well, but in retrospect, got a pretty good education at the time because of my reading. I came back in 1971, where we'd lived before. My father was still attached to Columbia University, and went to Scarsdale High School, and found that while I had read a lot, I didn't have the discipline, the background, the facts, and so didn't do particularly well. Graduated with a 2.75 average, but did a lot of writing, and was publishing some writing, and by the skin of my teeth got into the University of Rochester, and found that everything I'd read for the last 6 years suddenly kicked in. And I got straight A's without a problem. And a professor took me aside one day there and said, "You really need to go somewhere else now. You've gotten everything you got here." I said, "Where should I go?" He said, "Yale." I said, "Okay." So I transferred. Applied and transferred. It was, and I loved Yale. It was really a fun place. After Yale, I taught at Yale China. Through the Yale China program, I taught at Lingnan University in Hong Kong, and realized one day, I was teaching English and American literature, and I was preparing a lecture and realized most of what I was teaching were things I'd learned from my peers at Yale, not from my classes. You know, sitting around the dining room table, it really was a vibrant, interesting place to be.
And so I think you helped us understand why the trajectory leading to be a journalist, the conditions that pushed you in that direction. Question now is, you're also a writer. You've written several books, even a novel about life in Afghanistan, I guess, before an American invasion. Let's talk about writing. What led you to become a writer? How did that piece come together?
Fundamentally, I think I have a writing gene. I come from a very verbal family. All of us seem to be writers. All the kids in the family sort of have different aspects of writing. I have a younger sister who just published a book on constitutional law. Another younger sister wrote a funny book about medicine once. So I think that's the first thing, just coming from this huge, turbulent family where our dining room table was always covered with books, newspapers, and magazines, where I started reading The New Yorker, I think, when I was three or four, for the cartoons, because it was lying around. So I think before I was a journalist, I was a writer. I went to college assuming I'd become a professor of English literature. Teaching English and American literature in Hong Kong, I found that, what I really liked was writing. That was the attraction to me. When I compare what I was doing to what my young American friends in Hong Kong were doing, which mainly were journalists, they were having more fun. First of all, people gave them credit cards to go places. And that seemed like such a nice racket to me. I mean, you get to get on an airplane, check in a hotel, buy your meals, rent the car, and they pay for everything? Sounds good to me. So I went to the Wilson Quarterly, a magazine published by the Smithsonian. Went from there to eventually the Wall Street Journal. Enjoyed the Wall Street Journal. It really was that credit card knock around type of thing. Spent 17 years there, then moved to the Washington Post, and I was there for 8 years. I have to say, though, in retrospect, I was never entirely comfortable as a journalist. I always sensed the limitations of journalism. I was really struck by a line in Evelyn Waugh's novel Scoop. News is what people who don't care much about anything read. It really is about the ephemeral and frequently about the trivial. And I would find myself at odds with those demands a lot. I remember one day an editor of mine walked up with a sad look on his face at the Washington Post and said, "Tom, your lead on this story," the first sentence, he said, "it's just not a Washington Post lead." I looked at him and said, "Thank you." You know, that's not what I'm trying to do here, is write typical.
What does it mean to be somebody who gives over their life to writing? What is that experience like for the person who is the writer?
You know, I'm always sort of puzzled when people talk about how painful writing is. A friend of mine used to have a poster on his wall: "Writing is easy. You just stare at a typewriter until beads of blood appear on your forehead." And I just never got that. I've always liked to write. I used to think about this when I was interviewing David Petraeus a lot in Iraq. Petraeus has to run every day. Some people need to run 5 miles a day. I really need to write 1,000 words a day. It's one reason I do a blog, because sometimes when I'm doing book research, you really don't do much writing for a week or two at a spell. So for me, there's a simple joy, just a sitting and writing and putting stuff together. Yesterday afternoon, I took 3 hours and wrote an introduction to a book about T.E. Lawrence that a friend of mine is writing and asked me to help him out with the introduction. It was a pleasure. I sat down, I think around 1:30, and I stood up at 5:30, and I had 980 words on the page. He'd asked for 800 words. So. For me, it's the most natural process in the world. Recently, on a Monday morning, I woke up at 5 a.m., and my wife said, "Why are you getting up so early?" And I said, "I haven't written since Friday."
So do you, is it as if what you write just flows through you? Or it doesn't sound like for you it's a struggle. It's a joy.
That's right. It is a joy. And the funny thing was, the newspapers were a struggle with me. I was never, I won a couple of Pulitzer Prizes. I was part of teams that won Pulitzer Prizes. But journalism was never easy for me. It always was kind of feeling like my shoulders were hitting the box. I'd never feel that way in book writing. Book writing to me is almost like taking dictation. I mean, especially with Fiasco, which was written in a 360-day frenzy, where I just worked nonstop. I mean, it was 360 days of 18-hour days without a break. But for me, that book especially was just, boom, sit down and write. With very little looking back, in fact, very little revision on it. I finished writing it, I remember, in December, and I went downstairs to the basement where my wife was writing her own book. And I said, "I finished it." She said, "What do you think?" I said, "I don't care if it doesn't sell a single copy. I've written what I set out to write." For me, it was just, here's my testimony about what's going on. And I was talking about this last night in my lecture. The only reason I can think of to write a book is because you really are compelled to. You have to get out of your head. It's something that's nagging you. And you can either have all these thoughts and words chasing around inside your skull, or you can get them out. So for me, it was kind of almost a process to, what the hell happened in Iraq? I was trying to sort of puzzle through. Here's this U.S. military, which I've covered for a long time. I have a lot of friends in the military, a lot of people I admire in the military. How could this magnificent institution screw it up so badly? And that was the driving question for me behind Fiasco.
But before we talk about your works on Iraq, I'm curious, what was the factor or factors that led to your interest in the military?
It actually goes back to the 1970s. And two events that really struck me. 1975, I was in college, and Saigon fell. And for me, that was a real timeout moment. Wait a second. You know, all those demonstrations my parents hauled me to when I was a little kid about Vietnam. Nobody ever said, the result of this is going to be a communist takeover of South Vietnam. And watching that unfold with the Cambodian Holocaust, with the boat people fleeing Vietnam, I think America, especially the American left, has never really come to terms with what that meant. Were we really right? And including, the U.S. government. I actually think the assassination of Diem in 1963 in Vietnam was a disastrous moment in the Vietnam War. and really something we should keep in mind. So the first event is the fall of Saigon. The second event was the fall of Kabul in December 1979. Again, wait a second. This is not how it's supposed to be. There are not supposed to be Soviet tanks rolling through my old neighborhood. And so those two events were a real kind of political awakening for me that made me think what I've been taught to assume about the world, about the U.S. military, isn't really accurate. So I need to study this more myself. What I found, I was by accident for the Wall Street Journal in the neighborhood of Grenada when we invaded that country. So I was kind of just thrown into it. And then subsequently was thrown in as a backup reporter into Central America. What I found covering the military was I really enjoyed it. One of the problems of newspaper reporting in Washington, D.C. is there's a certain bloodlessness to it. You cover the State Department, it's just policy. It's not really real. The White House is very constrained in what you can cover, people you can talk to. Congress actually is a bit more lively because it's a lot of different people doing things. And intelligence is a horrible beat because everybody always lies to you. What I found with covering the military is you have real people doing real things. And so you don't just have policy at the tactical level. You can actually go out and see things. You can compare. What's the policy? What's the theory? What's the practice? What's the reality on the ground, which endlessly intrigued me. You can write about foreign policy, technology, demographics. It's a great way of looking at America, as I did in using the book Making the Core, to look not just at the Marines, but also the 18-year-old American, who I found, to my surprise, to be the most articulate of critics once he trusted you in his discussion of American society. So I came to really enjoy the military just as a broad subject of endlessly interesting. And also, I love history. And I found before I wrote about anything, there was always a good book of history. You're going to go on an aircraft carrier, read about the history of aircraft carriers, read about how carriers operate, and so on.
Mm-hmm. So in the aftermath of the end of the Cold War and the aftermath of 9/11, you actually were, as a journalist, were going around to a lot of the hot spots and getting a feel on the ground for how the military was adapting to essentially the new world that they had to act in ways that call for a very different mission.
When I took the Pentagon beat, I'd been an editor. I took the Pentagon beat in 1991, I think it was. And I remember my boss took me aside and said, you know, the Cold War is over, and so what you're really going to do is cover the conversion of the U.S. military into other things. Like, airplane manufacturers are now going to make refrigerators, he said. Remember that phrase. That's going to be what you write about. Okay? It turned out he was obviously entirely wrong. What I found myself was in a nonstop run for several years, Somalia, Bosnia, Haiti, Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan. And it was an adaptive process. And in fact, I was in Mogadishu with the 1st Battalion, 7th Marines in December 1991 and wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal about the Marines adapting to this mission. But I remember walking along a dusty road near the Mogadishu airport with Corporal Armando Rodriguez, who was an acting squad leader. And I said, how did you get to a situation where you're this young man in this strange country in a difficult environment, and you're leading this squad through this? And I said, guy your age, your background, your education, we wouldn't trust to run the Xerox machine in my office. And here we are essentially trusting you with national policy. And he said, it's all about Paris Island. And I said, okay, I got to look into that. Mm-hmm. Made a mental note. Went down to Paris Island and said, yeah, there's going to be a book in this about this. And so really, as the military was adapting, I was looking at that constantly and writing books about that over the course of 20 years.
You may run home for a long time. Run for a long time. You may run home for a long time. But let me tell you, God Almighty, God Almighty. Cut you down. Go tell that a long tongue liar. Go tell that a midnight rider. Tell the gambler, rambler, back about her. Tell him God Almighty's gonna cut him down. Great God Almighty, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dews. I've been down on my bending knees, talking to the man from Galilee. My God spoke so sweet. I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He put one hand on my head. Hey, God Almighty, let me tell you what he said. You may run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. You may run home for a long time. But let me tell you, God Almighty's gonna let you down. You may throw a rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But sure as God made the day and the night, what you do in the dark will be brought to light. You may run and hide, slip and slide, try to take the mold from your neighbor's eyes. But sure as God made the bridge and the pole, what you reap, my brother, is what you sow. You may run on for a long time. Run on for a long time, and they run home for a long time. But let me tell you, God Almighty, don't let you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go tell that a midnight rider. Tell the gambler, rambler, backbiter. Tell them, God Almighty, don't let them down. Some people go to church just to signify. I try to make a date with his neighbor's wife. But neighbor, let me tell you, just to choose your bone, you better leave that woman, well, leave her alone. Now, one of these days, you just mark my words. You will think that brother is going to work. When he walk up, I knock on the door. That's all, brother, you'll knock no more. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go tell that midnight rider. Tell the gambler, rambler, backbiter. Tell him God Almighty's gonna cut him down.
And now for something completely different.